It is my privilege to introduce to you the speaker in just a moment. It's my twin brother, and he is coming here with his wife Beth and his daughter Sarah. And they're from Nashville, Tennessee. And they also brought along with them my mother, Melissa. And so be sure to say hi to them afterwards and greet them with as much hospitality as you can muster. So
it says up there, Daniel 1:1-7. The bulletin says Ezekiel 11:12. So that's what I'm reading. And you shall know that I am the Lord, for you have not walked in my statutes or executed my judgments, but have done according to the customs of the Gentiles, which are all around you.
I was trying to get as much scripture as I could out so that I wouldn't have to do it. And by the way, John, we didn't come to see you. We came to see your boy. Am I on?
Yeah.
Okay, good. It's kind of hard to tell. As you may not have noticed, and if you hadn't heard John, he is my twin. I am the older brother. 1 minute. That counts. I am older and I have authority over him. I get more inheritance than him. One time when we were in high school, we were in Lads to Leaders, and we both got to speak like a 5-minute speech to a large group of people. We were both really excited about it, and I went up after John and I said, "Oh, don't worry, you're not experiencing deja vu," you know, kind of like a joke about, yeah. They reacted about the same way you just did. And that was really awkward because I had to spend my whole 5 minutes after saying a joke that didn't even land. So, but you guys are being really good to me already. You're making me feel really good. We're really happy to be here. I hope you can meet my wife and daughter, Sarah. My wife, Beth, my daughter, Sarah, who seems to be running away right now. She is awesome. I'm telling you. I love her so much. But anyway, you know, this lesson actually came from, you know, my new experiences and thoughts as a father. When Sarah was born, some of the things that really echoed throughout my mind were, how am I going to raise a daughter in this kind of world? The sermon title is Living in a Lost Land. To be more specific, I'm talking about the whole world. I'm talking about the United States. I'm talking about all countries all around. All people of earth are lost unless they have Jesus Christ. And we're living in a world where we can see the sin and the suffering and all of the ill effects that come from a godless nation and a godless world. You know, I'm actually in school to be an EMT right now. So I've spent some time on some ambulances before, and I tell you, that's really one of the best places to go see what kind of a world we're living in. And you know, it's not for the faint of heart. And so I think about, how am I going to raise my girl to be strong and to be faithful in all of this? And so, you know, I couldn't help but think of Daniel. Turn with me to the book of Daniel. We'll look at chapter 1. And his story is the ultimate example of... his story is the ultimate example of a man who lived surrounded by lost people in a lost land, and yet he remained faithful. You know, this topic is very rich. If I could, I would talk for a long time just about Daniel's life. There's so many examples of how he stepped forward, how he stood out, how he stood up to the tyrants. We can't talk about all of it. We're going to focus in on just the first chapter. But I would really encourage you, and this is kind of the theme of this whole sermon, is study further of what we're going to talk about, what we're going to look at. Read the book of Daniel, thinking about how it helps you, as you and I, we live in a lost land. Think about what Daniel did and how we can do the same thing in our own lives. So, We're going to start in chapter 1. Oh, I do want to say one thing before we continue. Because with this topic of sermon, it is very easy to get very pessimistic about this country, about this world. It's very easy to start complaining about the state of things without really doing anything about it. And I think if we focused on 2019 America, then, you know, we could really get into some trouble, because guess what? The world has always belonged to Satan, hasn't it? Ever since the fall, the world has been lost. And so we're going to speak very general about our culture, and let's focus on what we can do individually and what this congregation can do to make positive impacts, to stand up to the temptations. Chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz. Yeah, I see why you didn't read this, all these names. Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration of the king's choice food, and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they would enter the king's personal service. Now among them, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. We'll stop there. Israel has seen better days. You know, first we have the big division where the northern kingdom, Israel, gets captured by the Assyrians. And then later, all that's left is Judah with the capital Jerusalem, and they get captured by the Babylonians here. King Nebuchadnezzar, he takes vessels from the holy temple. He sacks Jerusalem, and not only that, he kidnaps young men, the ones that are the best of the best, the ones he can use. You know, what better prize to take than, you know, a nation's future, a nation's young population of people who will be the next leaders. All of this devastation would be enough to shake anybody's faith, wouldn't it? It'd be enough to shake mine and yours. And I imagine how hard it would be, how tough it would be to survive and to have your faith survive. Before we get to how Daniel reacted, though, I do want to point out something that we might be tempted to overlook. It's that, keep your fingers in the book of Daniel. We're going to go backwards and look at Ezekiel. We did have Ezekiel 11:12 read to us just a second ago. And we really need to remember that verse. We really need to remember the situation in its entirety. I'll go ahead. Oh. All right. That's the verse that was read to us. But let me give a little context. Ezekiel takes place in about the same time as Daniel, talking about the same captivity to the Babylonians. And there's some different thoughts and theories about exactly what years these things took place. We're not going to dig into that. But let's suffice it to say that Ezekiel was dealing with the same thing that Daniel was dealing with. And so, in chapter 8, excuse me, in chapter 8 of Ezekiel, Ezekiel has this vision, and he sees Jerusalem, and he sees terrible, godless things happening in Jerusalem. And every time he goes and he turns a street corner, he sees something horrible. Idol worship, people being neglected, all these things. And every time he sees something, the Lord says to him, "Do you see this? You're going to see worse than this." So he takes them throughout the city, and finally he makes it to the temple. And he tears a hole in the wall of the temple to a secret room. And these priests are worshiping idols. All these animal figures dancing, and I imagine something terrible, like really like a horror movie when I read it. When they're worshiping not Jehovah God, they're worshiping idols and things that are useless, things that are evil, abominations. And then finally, God has had enough. In chapter 9, God calls on His angels, and they go out and they slaughter the people in Jerusalem, except for the remnant, except for those that remained faithful. Now, remember, this is a vision. It's actually a prediction or a retelling of what Nebuchadnezzar did when he came and destroyed Jerusalem. And then after that, God does something even worse. He leaves the temple. He abandons His people because they abandoned Him. It's such a sad and harrowing thing to see God depart. Really, really scary as well. But in chapter 11, as we're reading this verse here, God gives the reason He did it. Why did He leave? Why did He enact His judgment? Chapter 11, I'll start in verse 9 to help us with context. He says, "And I will bring you out of the midst of the city and deliver you into the hands of strangers and execute judgments against you. You will fall by the sword. I will judge you to the border of Israel, so you shall know that I am the Lord. This city will not be a pot for you, nor will you be flesh in the midst of it, but I will judge you to the border of Israel. Thus you will know that I am the Lord. For you have not walked in my statutes, nor have you executed my ordinances, but have acted in according to the ordinances of the nations around you." And you see up here in the NIV, you know, it says, "You have conformed to the standards of around you." That's a huge temptation for us today, isn't it? It's so much easier, or at least it seems, to just conform to everything that's going on around us, just be, to go with the flow. That's a really big temptation for me. You know, for those of you in the Enneagram class, as a 9, that's a real big temptation for me. And those of you who aren't, go see John's class. There's a little commercial for you. So, we need to realize that Daniel was probably pretty used to living in a lost land, wasn't he? He's a godly man. He was faithful, and yet he, before even going to Babylon, he was surrounded by people doing terrible things. He was surrounded by bad influences. He grew up in it. And so now he's being captured and taken from one lost land to another. But this one is different. And I would argue to say worse. The first thing they do when they take him is they try to change everything about him. They try to make him forget their past life, Daniel and his friends. And of course, you know his friends, don't you? Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. What are their other names? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We know them very well. Why do we know them by different names? Because their names were changed by the Babylonians. Let's go back to Daniel. Hopefully you kept your finger there. And I had read verse 6. Let's look on to verse 7. "Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them, and to Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego." And what's the difference of these names? Well, we don't have time to really dig down into what these names mean, but each of the names of these Israelite boys honored God. Daniel's name means "God is my judge." Let me see here. Try to find my place real quick. We don't have time to go deep into that, so I won't bore you with that. But all of their names honored God. And what did the Babylonians do? They changed their name to honor an idol, or to honor a false god, a fake evil god. And that's just one of the many ways that they tried to get them away from their culture they were used to, away from the God that they served. and to serve others, other gods, to serve the gods of Babylon. Now, you might recall John actually preached on the book of Daniel a while back. I think it was probably a year and a half to 2 years ago. And he spoke about living in a land of identity theft. If you might remember that, he spoke about that. And I listened to that in preparation for this. He did a really good job talking about how Satan wants to take away our identity, strip it away from us in this world. And we need to guard against that like Daniel did. And that's really important. I'm going to go ahead and focus on the other thing that the Babylonians did. They not only changed the names, what else did they do? They tried to feed them. Feed them really good king's food. Tried to feed them a portion from the king's table, the meat and the wine. Things that must have tasted really good, must have looked really nice, really appetizing. Because what else are they trying to do besides making them forget their past life? They're trying to make them like this new life. These guys are going to be officials. These guys are going to be advisors. They want them to like Babylon, and so they're trying to bribe them with luxury. They probably had really nice places to live. They probably had a lot of freedom and things that they could do to enjoy their time. But this food is just one other example. They wanted them to be healthy, and they wanted them to be happy and full. And so they would forget. And so we've got the food and the names. Those are the two things that we're going to be focusing on. Just one problem with that food, though, isn't there? Daniel knew that it was unclean. Let's take a look at chapter 1, verse 8. We're going to read through verse 16 just to see this story, how it unfolds. Now we get to see Daniel's reaction to all these things the Babylonians are trying to change. Verse 8, but Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths of your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them and this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were to drink and kept giving them vegetables. So here we see Daniel take a stand. He refuses to defile himself. And I really believe that he would have made this choice regardless of what this commander would have said to him. You see what it says there in verse 8? But Daniel made up his mind. He knew he was not going to defile himself. He knew he was not going to partake of that food. So he goes up and he tries a very peaceful manner in which to solve it. And God has favor on him. God sees him through. But what would have happened if the commander had said no? Would Daniel have given up? Would he have started eating the king's food? No, he had made up his mind that he was not going to defile himself, no matter what the consequences would have been. And it's because of that that we see Daniel winning over and over and over again in the book of Daniel, because God shows favor to his courage and him standing up for his faith. We see Daniel act very courageously. We see him stand out And instead of standing by and allow his identity, his name to be changed, but what do we see in the book of Daniel? He keeps his name throughout the book. Whereas, you know, I'm not going to insult Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, but by the time they get to the fiery furnace, their names are Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Daniel's name doesn't change. He keeps his identity. And so, like I said, we could really talk a long time about this, about the book of Daniel. I would love just going through each story, going up to the lion's den especially. That's my favorite, one of my favorite stories. But of course, we really don't want, have the time to do that. What I want to do, or I think what's really important, is for us to apply this to ourselves. Because we read this story, and we have a great leader to follow. We have a great person to exemplify. We have a person who we can use as example in our own lives. Excuse me. So, what about our story? What about our situation? Let's just look at those two examples, the two things that the Babylonians try to do. And let's just take them to our own age. Because here, in all reality, we have the same thing happening to us. Because Satan wants to change our name, and he wants to feed us his food. So let's talk about Satan wanting to change our name first. You know, I think about how, what does the name Christian mean today? It could mean a lot of things. Hey, Sarah. The name Christian. What does it mean to our culture? You know, I imagine a lot of things that people might say, and not many of them are good, are they? Why is that? It's because Satan wants to change the name Christian. You know, it's funny, you know, he takes something that is so good and he turns it into its opposite. You know, Christians are supposed to be loving, compassionate, peaceful people. And Satan has successfully twisted the word Christian to mean intolerant, hateful, angry. And we could go on and on and on. Stupid, you know, all sorts of derogatory terms that we could think of that people describe Christians. And this is really tough for some of us who are believers are really tempted to kind of fall in line and think that way. Because we hear it over and over and over again. We're tempted to believe it. And of course, there are other Christians who help it out, right? Because we're not perfect. And some of us, you know, some of us don't really, some of us call ourselves Christians, but we don't act like Christians. And they help the narrative. But true Christians need to be fighting this narrative tooth and nail. Let's look at John chapter 15. John chapter 15. I'll start in verse 18. I'm going to go over to this side. John chapter 15, we find Jesus with his disciples. He knows that this is his last night with them, so he spends a great deal amount of time talking with them in the upper room, and then even after that going on to other places with them. Chapter 15, verse 18, Jesus says, "If the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you are of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a slave is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also." Are we any better than Jesus? They attacked Jesus. They killed Jesus. They called him names. They said he had a demon. They said he was a glutton. They wanted to change what people thought about Jesus, change his name so badly, and then finally they had had enough and they killed him. We are his followers, and the world is going to hate us too. And it'll be that way until Jesus comes back, won't it? You know, and I'm not saying that we can't make the world better. I'm not saying we can't make a big influence. That's what this sermon is supposed to be all about. We can make a difference. But we need to keep in mind what Jesus said. You know, if Jesus couldn't convert everybody he met, then there's no way that we're going to be able to. That shouldn't be discouraging us from speaking out. And we'll look a little bit more about what Daniel did and his impact, just because he kept the faith throughout his whole life towards the end. Let's go ahead and go to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. And go ahead, when you open it up, keep a finger in there, because we're going to go back to 1 Peter when we talk about Satan's food. We're going to start in verse 11. First Peter chapter 2:11. He says, "Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men." You know, what's the answer when Satan tries to change the name Christian? What is the answer to that? By living like Christ did. And then everybody who calls us names will be proven to be a liar. And every word that they speak will just condemn what they say. It's really important that we don't lash out, that we don't attack those who attack us. It's really important that we always show love to our enemies. That way, when they attack us, there's nothing that vindicates them. There's nothing that excuses them in the eyes of anybody looking. And I'm not saying we should all be martyrs. I'm saying we should go and love the world. And like Daniel, we should stand up for our faith regardless of consequences. So what's the second way that the Babylonians try to change Daniel and that Satan tries to change us? He wants to give us his food. Looks pretty good, doesn't it? You know, that stuff looks pretty good too, right? You know, let me ask you this. If you ate a donut and you immediately gained 10 pounds, would you ever eat donuts? I wouldn't. Honesty. Yeah. Food, you know, unhealthy food is really good. It tastes so good, and we eat it, and we, you know, sometimes we don't feel so good after we eat it, but we don't really notice a huge change at first, right? It's very subtle. We start developing a habit. We start eating unhealthy all the time, and then we have health problems later down the road. And then once we're told to go on a diet, how hard is it to go on that diet? It's really hard. Especially when the hand is holding that really good food out to us all the time. You know, you just drive down the road and see all these signs of places that are so delicious. It's really hard to keep a diet. You got a lot of restaurants in here, in this area. A lot of good restaurants, too. But what is Satan's food? What is Satan's food? I'd say if we wanted to define what Satan's food is, we would narrow it down to Satan's message. Or maybe to put it better, his thinking, his mindset. And he wants to feed it to us all the time. And guess what? We're only happy to start chowing down, aren't we? I think about TV, movies, video games, books, all of the media that we watch and consume. And we consume so much every day, don't we? And I think about our coworkers that talk to us and convince us of things. And I think about our friends and our family that we spend time with. You know, how often do we spend time watching a TV show or a movie that, you know, has some bad stuff in it versus how much time we read the Bible? And how much time do we spend with, you know, friends who might be a bad influence on us versus the Lord's church? You know, and I also look at, you know, I look at the political landscape. There's a lot of Satan's food in the political landscape right now and always. And, you know, it's important for us, you know, as Americans to vote and to be involved with our country's government and how things are, and be aware of how things are going. But if we spend so much time focused on that and consuming all of Satan's food from everybody who speaks in that realm, and less time with the kingdom that will never perish, God's kingdom, this church, how are we going to be? Maybe it's time for us to take a spiritual diet. Satan's food is really good. Except once you take it in, you feel really bad. You feel really, really bad. Let's look at, if you want to turn to Philippians chapter 4, verse 8, I would encourage you to memorize that verse. It's a really important verse. Paul speaks and he talks about what we spend our time doing, and he says, "Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about these things." If we spend our time in with God's food, with the Bible, with His Christians, with wholesome media, with wholesome books, that's a diet that we need that will help our spiritual lives, especially down the road. You know, you don't watch a bad movie and then immediately get a potty mouth, right? It's gradual. But if you're eating so much of Satan's food all the time, and then you don't get enough God's food, it's going to outweigh God's food so quickly. Now, so far we've been talking about Satan's food that we feed ourselves. There's also Satan's food that he force feeds us, that we have no choice but to hear the message. I think about, you know, someone who might be in a class that teaches evolution, or someone who might be in a class that speaks ill of godly values. You know, they have to write a paper. They can't ignore it. They can't just walk out. They have to listen, right? Well, I would have two pieces of advice for that kind of... I'll give another example. Someone who has a job and they're forced to work with ungodly people. Forced to interact with them. You can't go out and just immediately grab another job. It's not that easy, right? And in fact, whatever job you grab, you'll probably be in the same situation. So two pieces of advice for that food that comes to us that we have no choice but to hear it. Number one, my daughter Sarah can teach you how to avoid taking medicine, right? Every time we try to feed her medicine, she fights it tooth and nail. I tell you, she wrestles us, and like her life depends on it. No! And she fights it so hard that sometimes we're tempted to just give up giving it to her. You know, but Satan's food isn't medicine. It really is as bad as Sarah thinks her medicine is. So if we just need to close our jaw, and whenever it comes, whenever those messages come, we need to just shake them off. We need to realize that this is Satan's food. You know, that's probably the most important thing you can do when Satan's feeding you. If you realize that that's Satan's food, what are you going to do with it? You're going to throw it away. If you can realize it, then that's going a long way. The second piece of advice is eat more God's food. If you spend your day, every day, reading the Bible and praying, how is that going to help you when you go to the workplace and you're surrounded by people who speak ungodly things, who want to convince you, who want to attack you? God's food is pure. It's sacred. We were supposed to be going for milk and meat spiritually. We're supposed to be feasting on God's pure meat and food. So, let's bring this all together. Let's talk about Daniel's uncompromising faith and what that means. Daniel chapter 6. I'll say one more time, read the book of Daniel. Think about this world. Think about what we can do. Think about your own life. In chapter 6, we have the story of the lion's den. I wish we could read over the whole thing. We definitely do not have the time. And that's okay. You know, that Billy Smith, who's the dean at Fried Hardeman, used to say, the mind can only take as much as the seat can endure. I think that's true. Some seats can endure more than others, right? All right, we're going to look at chapter 6, verse 25. To give a little context, Daniel gets thrown into the den of lions because he refused to worship an idol and refused to worship a false god. And his other satraps, the other people that were advising the king, were jealous of how good he was doing and how pure his character was. And so they enacted this whole plan, and they won, and they threw him in the lion's den. The king, Darius, loved Daniel, and he hated seeing Daniel thrown in the lion's den, but of course, he made this a law, and he didn't want to break the law in front of everybody. It would completely destroy his reputation and his authority as king. So he threw Daniel in reluctantly, and he said, may your God save you. You know, because he knew Daniel, and he knew Daniel's God because of how Daniel lived. And he spent up all night, Darius, the king, he was up all night worried about Daniel. And finally he goes to the den, and he says, Daniel, did your God save you? And verse 20, let me see here. Verse 21, then Daniel spoke to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me. Inasmuch as I also was found innocent before him, and also towards you, O king, I have committed no crime. So Darius was so happy to hear that, and he was so happy to see Daniel rescued. And once the satraps are punished, he in verse 25, let's look. Then Darius the king wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language who were living in all the land, may your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever. And his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. Who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Darius writes a letter to everyone in the land, of all nations, all languages. Remember, this is the Babylonian Empire, right? They had the whole known world. So in effect, this is a letter that the king writes to the whole world, telling them to fear and tremble before Daniel's God, the God of Israel, Jehovah. Because Daniel had uncompromising faith, because he lived his life standing out from the crowd, not conforming to the world around him, look at that huge impact he made. You know, I just think about what we can do. What can we do in this land? Well, who's behind us? Who's watching over us? There's so much we can do to make a positive influence on this world, but we've got to remain uncompromising in our faith. And we've got to keep Satan from changing our name and keep him from feeding us his lies. We need to throw away his food, eat God's food, keep our name of Christian pure, and keep our faith uncompromising, and we will continue to make an influence like Christians have always done. Just look throughout history and you'll see what Christians are able to do in a lost land. Let's close by looking at these two verses. The first one we read earlier in the sermon, and we had read for us before the sermon. And the second one was read at the very beginning of worship. Let's take a look. First, and you will know that I am the Lord. Remember, this is God telling them why he left, why he delivered them to the Babylonians. For you have not followed my decrees or kept my laws, but have conformed to the standards of the nations around you. And now what does Paul say in Romans 12:2? Can you say this with me? Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Let's not conform. Let's be transformed by God's food. Let's be transformed by constantly meditating on His Word. And then we can go out into this world unafraid. And people might attack us, might try to change who we are. But what's going to happen? We are going to maintain our faith. We're going to maintain our identity by staying the course, by love and compassion. And so all those liars who talk against us will be put to shame. And then as we continue to feed ourselves on God's Word and His statutes, we can grow, become better people, a better congregation. We can love each other all the more. And then those who see us will glorify God. We can really change the world with this, just by sticking to what God has and not abandoning Him, not conforming. So if there's anyone here this morning who needs to come forward, who wants to put on Christ in baptism, or needs prayers from the church, or anything that you need, we have people here who will help, who are willing to talk. And so I would encourage you to do that now as we stand up and sing this song.
I'm going to muster up all the hospitality that I possibly can to say, James, thank you so much. We appreciate the message you brought us. We thank you for the way it challenges and encourages us. And I think for our hospitality to reach its final and most important source, we need to mention Melissa, who is the mom who raised these two young men. And Melissa, we honor you in the Lord for your life and for the training that you provided. And we thank you for James, for John, and through them, for Beth, for Carissa, for Luke, for Sarah. And we honor you on behalf of your faith. John?